Before we get into the lesson, I've had several comments about it's like the Sunday morning lessons that I'm going too fast, hard to take notes and stuff. On the one hand, my rhythm is probably a little bit faster than a lot of people's. That's one problem. The other is hopefully solved. All the lessons from Philippians, which we've just got through doing, and all the Psalms up into this one are on the website. Just got them loaded this weekend. So if you want all the information, in fact, what's on the website is in more detail than what you're getting in the presentations. Okay. So you haven't missed anything if you want it. Also, so since I've started this, I've been able to push a little bit ahead, so like 2 weeks ahead now on the lessons. So if you want a copy of the lesson, like Joe's asked for copies of it before, I can get you, I can get you this and before the lesson, and you can kind of either follow along or read it ahead of time and sleep through the sermon, whatever your little heart desires. Right? If you want the information, you can have it one way or the other. We'll get it to you, whatever your needs are, whatever your ambitions, whatever your druthers. We're here to please. We are servant of the people. We are here to be a liaison between you and God and to bring to you his, this evening, what we're looking at is Psalms 15. And for one thing I can tell you, if I go over Sunday morning, it'll be a little bit shorter Sunday night. If it's a little long Sunday night, it'll probably be short Sunday morning. I try to find this little balance between it. So, I'm always trying to make you happy. This evening, Psalms 15, and it's a short one. It's 5 verses. So, if I don't get motor-mouthed, like I'm already having a tendency to do, we should get out here ahead of time. Psalms 15, we call it a true worshiper in Zion. I'm glad that, that Tom read what he did. Goes along with what is true worship. And if you're wondering what that little picture is, in Jerusalem, they've actually have a model that's a reconstruction of Jerusalem from the first century. So if you're ever there, look that up. It's incredible, all the suburbs and everything else, in detail, to scale, of Jerusalem 2,000 years ago. And so this is a little picture of it, of what they thought of Zion back then, but really what Zion is the Church of God, okay, which we are now. So from Psalms 15, first of all, that this is a Psalm of David cannot be disproved. Okay, most of them are by David. There are some Psalms by others, but this one just seems, it doesn't come out and say this is a Psalm of David except the Hebrew notation on it, but the way it's worded and everything else in his background history, nobody's ever been able to say, other Psalms people can argue against whether David's the author, evidently not this one. Okay, it's just accepted as a Psalm of David. Now, it fits nicely into the life and activity of the monarch and precisely into that period of his life when he manifested an interest in the restoration of the ark, in the reestablishment of public worship. Okay? So he's moved the Ark of the Covenant into Jerusalem, and he's looking to set up, try to get the worship established again. And any man who lives close to God recognizes there are certain pitfalls of formalism and ritualism that continually tend to corrupt worship. I mean, this is something we can look at. How often do we come to services and just kind of half awake and just kind of slime through the service itself? We sit there, we go through the sermon or we go through the songs. We're really not listening to the words. Okay? We kind of, our mind wanders through the prayer, the Lord's Supper. We got our mind on other things. We just kind of ritually take the elements and pass it on. Okay, so that's always a problem we're going to have to struggle with in ourselves. that each time we come to force ourselves to get the spiritual aspect of it, what God intended us to do, the thinking about what we're doing, it's always going to be a struggle. And David realized that 3,000 years ago. So this is what that psalm is for. David may have therefore foreseen that with public worship reinstituted, the nation would have to be instructed to not be satisfied or content with just external services. Okay? We see this predominantly in other faiths, you know, where it may feel religious, you know, the smell of the candles, the stained glass windows, the organ music or whatever, but you know, David says, let's put all that aside and see what we're really spiritually trying to accomplish here. So, this psalm, therefore, seeks to establish the marks of a true worshiper. If the virtues listed here are not in evidence in the life of the worshiper, then his worship cannot be effective and his attitude can't be right. So this is a concise little checklist for ourselves as to, is our mind really where it should be? The author here then lists the bare essentials of proper examples without exhausting the case. Short, short psalm, to the point. And this psalm opens with a question, that sets the theme and is followed by a detailed answer by the author as if he's standing before the Lord. Looking at God and going, what does it take to be accepted by you? And the answers are in three broad principles of conduct and then a number of basic virtues equaling, 10 commandments, of proper behavior in the presence of God. So, the question, O Lord, who may abide in thy tent? Okay? Who may dwell on thy holy hill? Even before a temple was erected, there was a tent, a tabernacle. Okay? Who can come into it? Who can mount the hill where you dwell? This is the question, which boils down to, of whom does the Lord approve? Who will he allow to come into his presence, and whom will he not? Okay? That is something that's very special. Okay? Especially if you think back to Numbers, Nadab and Abihu, who got to be taken, the Lord lightly and decided any kind of fire was acceptable to him on the altar, and they died because of it. So when you start to take God lightly, terrible things can happen. Okay, the two parts of the question are both figurative, since no one, not even a priest, would think of taking up permanent residence in the tabernacle. You just don't do that. it's God's place. That's where he resides, nor presumed to take up perpetual residence on God's holy hill, where the tent was erected. In a sense, true worshipers who come into God's presence enjoy the rites commonly associated with Oriental hospitality. That is, if someone were to let you into his house or his tent in Oriental times, two things you could expect. One, he's going to feed you. And that's part of the hospitality. And the other is, he provides protection. We see this in the case of Lot, in the case of what we just looked at in Judges, where an individual's, in a person's home, and others come to take him out, and the person that owns the home stands up to them to protect them. Okay? So this is something of God's hospitality you can expect if he accepts you, invites you into his presence. He will sustain you. He will protect you. The word abide in the Hebrew term is actually the word ger, which means sojourn and means temporary residence, though not necessarily brief. So when we do come to visit God, it's usually on brief occasions, but it doesn't have to be too brief. Okay? Depending on, God likes your company or not. Bottom line. I've told you that before. Isn't that the bottom line? Are you the kind of person that God wants to have around for eternity? Think about it. Do you make friends easy? If you don't, are you making friends with God? Question amounts then to, whom, O Lord, will you accept when he comes to your house? Okay. Verse 2. He who walks with integrity and works righteousness and speaks truth in his heart. That's the beginning. The first principle is he who walks with integrity. Though it is sometimes translated perfectly, it signifies a completeness of moral conduct, a many-sided, well-rounded pattern of living that leaves no important area uncultivated. Remember the time we draw a little circle on the board with a lot of little compartments? We ask you, what's in the circle? Is it you? You're selfish? Or is it God? And if it's God, is he filling every one of those compartments? That of finances, that of friends, that of recreation, that of family, of church? Does he permeate every single aspect of your life, every single chamber of your heart? And that's important. I mean, a lot of times when they do profiles of serial killers, you know, and you start asking people, well, what's Ted Bundy like or whatever? And they'll go, well, he was a good student, he was a hard worker, you know, at the job, he was a nice neighbor, very pleasant, fairly quiet, never bothered anybody. And he was through most of the aspects of his life, except that when the full moon came out, you know, there was a little chamber in his heart that sought to go out and kill people. God says, no, every chamber has to be filled and controlled by God. And that's what integrity is. Every chamber has God in it. He rules over it. Second, stated more concisely, he works righteousness, or he does what's right. Inside, he's right. You know, he's seeking to establish a well-rounded sense of morals that present themselves outwardly in just doing what the right thing is. And that's what's right in God's sight, not in one's own. The main problem in the judges that we're studying is that each man did what was right in his own sight. And that's why they got into so much trouble. That's why their behavior got so bizarre. They thought they were doing okay. You know, but they didn't check in with God. If you want to come to God, you've got to do it on his terms, what he considers right and wrong. Third, added to both integrity and always doing the right thing, is an attitude of always seeking to speak the truth from the heart. Okay? His speech does not lie superficially on the tongue. That is, what's coming out, is it really what they're thinking? Okay, speech is always sort of an indicator, you know, of, you know, really what's going on. Three participles are used expressing the thought that these attributes must be enduring qualities. It's not just something, well, I want to get a little righteousness here. Maybe I can come to God. And then make it a bookshelf, you know, religion. No, these are ongoing things. It's a part of the person. Isaiah 33, who among us can live with a consuming fire? Who among us can live with continual burning? Hebrews 10 talks about God as being the consuming fire. Okay, look it up. Okay, and the wrath of God upon those that are pretty much hypocritical. He who walks righteously and speaks with sincerity, then you can survive in the presence of God. Fourth, is he does not slander with his tongue, nor does he evil to his neighbor, nor takes up reproach against a friend. The author changes to finite verbs and uses perfects to express what needs to be habitual. Okay, so the demand starts with, he does not slander with his tongue. Okay? No mouth can bless God and worship and slander a fellow Christian or brother. Okay, in the next breath, a New Testament writer put it this way. Okay? Familiar with James? James 3, 8 through 11, no one can tame the tongue. That's one of the first things we got to be careful of. What's coming out of our mouth? It is a restless evil. It is full of deadly poison. With it we bless our Lord and Father, and with it we curse men made in the likeness of God. From the same mouth comes both blessings and cursings. And James says, my brother, these things not to be. And he gives an example. Does a fountain send out the same, from the same opening, both fresh and bitter water? No way. You can't mix the two. If you've got bitter in with the fresh, it's going to come out bitter. That's what he's telling you. Don't mix it. Okay? God is looking for a sincere development from the heart out through, you know, what we speak. Fifth, it follows that one is excluded who is guilty of working what is wrong or evil to his neighbor. He is violating the second greatest commandment, not loving neighbor as self. Sixth, he will not promote anything of gossip that may be uttered to defame another's character. In essence, this is tantamount to bearing false witness. When you spread gossip, when you pick up something about another person and you spread it on to somebody else, okay, what are you doing? You're helping defame them. You're helping destroy their life. You're helping giving them a bad reputation that they do not deserve. This kind of person, God doesn't want around. Seventh, okay, and it starts four, in whose eyes a reprobate is despised, but who honors those who fear the Lord, he swears to his own hurt and does not change. He knows who deserves respect and who does not. A reprobate, one whose conscience has been damaged permanently by their wicked behavior, should get only one's wholehearted contempt. How many times have you heard about this old boy philosophy? You know, it could be among a fraternity in college. It could be among a police department. It could be in, you know, among law officials, judges, and lawyers, where it doesn't matter what's right or wrong, you stick up for your buddy. God says, I don't like that. If the person is bad, you don't defend them. If you're really their friend, you will try to correct them. But if he's a nasty, you know, person, okay, you've got to recognize that and deal with it accordingly. And not just say, well, he's a brother officer or he's a fraternity brother, and just, you know, sweep it under the rug or try to defend him. You've got to take sides. And hopefully what God says, you take the right side, even if you get ostracized for it. If everybody comes down for you. You know, this is the kind of mentality you pick up, you know, in grade school playgrounds. It doesn't hold water in the presence of God. Yet if one honors God, he himself must be honored. That is, you know, the other side of it. Notice Psalms 1, blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, or stand in the path of sinners, or sit in the seat of scoffers. That's the blessed man. And this is the one who should be honored. The man is doing what's right. You should be behind him. Okay? And you think this doesn't happen. I've heard a congregation and known the people were those that were fired up, wanting to do what's right, going out and talking to people, were bad-mouthed by other people in the congregation. And you go, what are you thinking? The trouble is, if we don't periodically go through these things and to see, you know, where God draws the line on which side he wants you to, you know, to live on that line, people have a tendency to kind of make it up on their own and think what they're doing is righteous and good and everything else. And we have to be reminded there are certain things that sometimes we kind of fall into that God will not accept, no way, no how, whatever. Eighth, one of the best tests of a proper attitude toward God would be to see what a man does when he has sworn an oath and then finds out it's going to go to his disadvantage. But he still goes out to carry, you know, to carry on what he swore. Okay. Business world, you can see this. Especially big corporations, a company makes an agreement with another company. Okay. You make these amount of widgets and we'll buy the widgets at this cost. But it takes time. You know, the other company has to get the materials together, has to start designing, you know, looking at the plans, whatever, maybe tooling up, buying machines to produce the amount of widgets that was ordered. And in the space of this time, the cost of something goes up. For either side. And perhaps, you know, in the agreement, One side of here says, well, we've got to renege on the contract because it's not to our advantage anymore. In fact, they will hire lawyers. The lawyers will look at everything and basically tell you that, okay, it is better to not go ahead with this contract. Let them take you to your court, and what you get sued for will be less than what you'd lose if you went ahead with it. And they justified by, well, we got to look out for the stockholders. We can get caught up in this sort of stuff. No longer, I mean, this is where our society's gone to. We're no longer is agreement made on a handshake or a man's word. Even now, if you get it in writing, it's no good. In fact, if you one of the things, you know, one of the autobiographies I read about Donald Trump, of the people he respected, one of them was Mr. Tiffany, because of this very thing. If you know, you know, Tiffany's diamonds and everything, he one time got in a contract, and as time progressed, the contract went against him, but he honored it anyway. He lost money. As far as, you know, Trump was concerned, that guy had integrity. And he would be one that he would do business with anytime, anywhere. And that's what you're building, a reputation for trust. If you build up a reputation that you'll get out of a contract any way possible because it goes against you, then you're becoming the kind of character God doesn't want around. Just thinking, going into this, this obviously implies that the original oath that was made was not rashly or inadvisedly, but with a solemn respect before God. He made an oath before God, you know, he made it before God. Now, are you going to go back on that? You know, what kind of respect do you have for God? I mean, you've called God as witness for this thing. I mean, does God want you around then when In my presence, you made this oath. You've made me a part of it, and now you expect me to go back on it? Yeah. God's going to say, I don't want this kind of person around me. Now, is this pertinent now? Marriage vows before God, he's the partner. Where God has joined together, let no man put asunder. When we go and enter into a marriage contract, we've brought God into it. We've made a vow that God has joined us together. He's a part of it. Do not take lightly then your vow to another person to love, honor, obey, your riches and poor, you know, sickness and health, you know, the whole thing that we attest to. It's a test. It's a test. If it goes sour, God wants to see what kind of person you are. You're going to stand by it or not. Ninth, he does not charge interest on the money he loans to others. A reference here is to the law, and the ethical nature of this demand is obvious. I'll explain a little more here. One is not to enrich oneself at a poor neighbor's expense. We looked at this in Deuteronomy. This is one of the reasons I wanted to go through the law. So you see some of these things that are required of us by God. True charity repudiates the idea of a personal gain as a result of usury. Okay, actually, two elements are here. The usury is the act or practice of lending money at an exorbitant or illegal rate of interest. Loan sharking. Yeah. 25 to 50%. Okay. You might even put in the term credit card. All right. Two things are shown. Exodus 22, if you lend money to my people, God says, to the poor among you, you are not to act as a creditor to him. That is, if you're trying to help somebody else out, you know, who's desperately in need of help, you know, are you going to keep him poor by charging an interest that keeps him poor? Or are you giving him something in order to help him out? I mean, it might even be you give it to him and it's a gift. I mean, he's poor. You don't know if he's going to pay it back or not. So why charge interest? Especially since he's your brother. Right? That's one aspect of it, dealing with the poor. Now, as we went through Deuteronomy, you see that, you know, among the Jews, You know, there's a difference between trying to help somebody out and then just doing regular business. And that's where the second part comes in. If you're going to do business and charge interest, I mean, God's not unfair in this. You know, if you're lending property or money or something like that to somebody, as long as they have that, you're going to be losing its potential. So at least, you know, you're right in yourself to kind of make it up. But do not take usurious interest from him, but revere your God that your countrymen may live with you. Little interest is no problem, but don't exact a pound of flesh. Tenth, bribery was a common offense in courts and government as in any so-called modern nation. Yeah, this has always been a problem we deal with. What else do I have? This is the reason so many third world economies are suffering, is because of the widespread practice of having to bribe officials to get anything done. Ran across this as a good explanation. Ralph Peters talks about, and he uses the example of Egypt. But a lot of these, you know, small countries, and even big ones, their economies never take off because of corruption. I mean, you can look across the border into Mexico. Half of the economy is run by the mafia. You know, I've talked to people from there that, you know, okay, yeah, I went and got my degree in engineering. This is one guy's talking to me. He said, I got my degree in engineering, but the money was furnished by the mafia. So now as I make a good living, half of it has to go back to them. Okay. This guy never gets ahead. You know, you don't get an entrepreneurial, you know, interest in things. You know, when Peter's talked about Egypt, he goes, okay, in order to get a business license, you know, it takes maybe 10 years to go through the paperwork, and only then if you've greased the skids and paid the officials, bribed them off and whatever, and they can't wait that long. You know, starved to death waiting 10 years just to get a business license. So they get in little back alleys, and they do business on the sly, they'll hang out a shingle, and they make just enough to get by. Now, if they're making just enough to get by, that means they're not getting anything into the government of its coffers through taxes or anything. And they're not going to make a big deal about it because they don't want to get noticed. And if everybody is doing this, a country never takes off. It can't afford itself. I mean, these are very practical things in order to run a life, and run a nation. So when God tells you something, start, you know, perking up. You know, his wisdom is inescapable. One last example of this. Just have a major problem in Haiti. Earthquake, I don't know how many died. I mean, they're still digging them up. Okay. The United States has been hit with stronger earthquakes than Haiti was. In our earthquakes, yeah, maybe, you know, 3 to 10 people will die. Them, there's like tens of thousands. What's the difference? Corruption. Corruption. Because, yeah, in order to get a place to live, you had to bypass the codes, you had to not tell anybody, you had to do it on the sly, and so they build up a whole culture that the minute the first thing comes along that shakes it up, it'll drop. The buildings weren't to code. They couldn't survive an earthquake. And we know you can build in order to do that, but they just weren't ready for it. Okay? Their own practice came back on them. And it'll always be that way. Okay? You know, isn't this what, you know, Jesus warns about? You build on the rock. Okay, good, solid principles. This is what God is trying to give us. And you can survive these things. He's trying to, you know, slipshod life, trying to get by, trying to lie, steal, cheat, whatever, and it's going to come down on you. Especially, you're not going to be allowed into the next world, at least not in the presence of God. Money that the poor do not have for bribery keeps them from accomplishments, and thus justice is not met, nor is one's living increased. Exodus 23:8, and you shall not take a bribe, for a bribe blinds the clear-sighted and subverts the cause of the just. Isaiah 1:23, your rulers are rebels and your companions of thieves. Everyone loves a bribe and chases after rewards. I mean, we're talking a prophet here. He's letting the people know what's going to tear you down and why God is putting you into exile. They do not defend the orphan, nor does the widow's plea come before them. You start neglecting those who really need help. The psalmist now has a final comment. Never to be shaken. Envisions ones who will never be moved from their position of godliness, either by temptation or by adversity. What you've done when you look at these Ten Commandments for approaching God, you build yourself a character that's steadfast, that will stand against anything that life throws against it. Your godliness will keep you from any kind of distress, adversity, problems, trials, or any temptation that comes along. You can weather it all because God's going to be with you. Okay. So what do we got here? Here it is. Who can abide in the presence of God? Make it simple. If you walk with integrity, you work righteousness, you speak the truth in your heart constantly. Keep on doing it. You don't slander with your tongue. You don't do evil to your neighbor. Nor do you take up a reproach against a friend in whose eyes a reprobate is despised. I mean, you point out the evil. You expose the what's going on in this world. Who honors those who fear the Lord, that you look out for those that highly respect God, and you side with them. You encourage them. You stand behind them. And who swears to his own hurt and doesn't change. That is, when you say you're going to do something, you're going to do it. Make sure it's the right thing. You know, but if it is the right thing, you know, even if it goes against you, you know, you're going to have the kind of character that's going to hold in there. Okay? And then he doesn't put out his money at interest or usury, does not take a bribe against the innocent. And he who does such things will never be shaken. Guaranteed by God. This is the invitation. What are you trying to accomplish in this life? These are the foundation elements of it. I mean, really trying to get on God's side, trying to get him in your life, trying to conduct yourself in such a way that he approves of you. He likes you. He wants to help you, like a father helping out a child. I mean, who isn't that here that doesn't have children that wants to see the best for them? That encourages them to go to school, that may set them up in business, may help them make the down payment for their first house. This is what parents do. They help people along. They help their children along, especially. This is what God wants to do for us. But do you feel like doing that to a child that's turned out to be a little stinker? No. I mean, the attitude is, leave him in jail for a couple of nights. You know, maybe he'll turn around. You know, this is the way God looks at it. No different than us. So don't sell God short. He can do so much for you. He can do everything for you. If you want your life to be turned around and you want it prepared for eternity, God always extends an invitation. These are the kind of people I'm looking for. If you really want to abide in my presence, this will do it. Guaranteed. Anything we can do to help, let us know as we stand and sing.